support. Amongst the four social orders, Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, and Shudras, the Kshatriyas, both men and women, are generally very beautiful. As it will be apparent from the following verses, it is to be concluded that not only were Maharaj Prithu's bodily features attractive, as described here, but he had specific, all auspicious signs in his bodily construction. As it is said, the face is the index of the mind. One's mental constitution is exhibited by his facial features. The bodily features of a particular person are exhibited in accordance with his past deeds. For according to one's past deeds, his next bodily features, whether in human society, animal society, or demigod society, are determined. This is proof of the transmigration of the soul through different types of bodies. King Prithu's body was tall and sturdy, and his complexion was fair. His arms were full and broad, and his eyes as bright as the rising sun. His nose was straight, his face very beautiful, and personality grave. His teeth were set beautifully in his smiling face. So Maharaj Prithu is coming into an arena to perform sacrifices. There were great sages, brahmanas, demigods from the higher planets, rajarshis, they had all assembled. So as the yajamana means the patron of the sacrifice, that is a patron means the one who pays for it. It means that person to whom the benefits of the sacrifice accrue. So that's the yajamana, the patron. So he's the yajamana. So he has to participate in the sacrifice. So he stands up in the midst of the assembly to come forward. And it appeared, it says, that the full moon had arisen among the stars. So now it describes, as he stands up, everyone looks to see him. And so as he stands up, he's described. And the next number of verses... Describe his bodily features. So I'll read those. There's no purport to those verses. So I'll read them so we can get the whole impact at once of his appearance on the people in this arena. So then there's today's verse. King Prithu's body was tall and sturdy, and his complexion was fair, Gaura. His arms were full and broad, and his eyes as bright as the rising sun, Aruna Ikshana. His lotus-like, Kansha Aruna Ikshana, his lotus-like eyes were as bright as the rising morning sun. His nose was straight, his face very beautiful, and his personality grave, Somya, of a grave bodily stature. That is to say, his demeanor or posture was all very grave. His teeth were set beautifully in his smiling face. So then it goes on to describe, says not only his beauty, but also that he had specific bodily markings which denote an incarnation of God or a very auspicious person. The chest of Maharaj Prithu was very broad. So everybody's looking at him, just as the moon had risen, so everyone's staring. He steps forward. His waist, very thick, and his abdomen, wrinkled by lines of skin, resembled in construction a leaf of a banyan tree. His navel was coiled and deep, his thighs were of a golden hue, and his instep was arched. The black, slick hair on his head was very fine and curly, and his neck, like a conch shell, was decorated with auspicious lines. He wore a very valuable dhoti, and there was a nice wrapper on the upper part of his body. As Maharaj Prithu was being initiated to perform the sacrifice, he had to leave aside his valuable dress, and therefore his natural bodily beauty was visible. It was very pleasing to see him put on a black deer skin and wear a ring of kusha grass on his finger, for this increased the natural beauty of his body. It appears that Maharaj Prithu observed all the regulative principles before he performed the sacrifice. Just to encourage the members of the assembly and to enhance their pleasure, King Prithu glanced over them with eyes that seemed like stars in a sky wet with dew. He then spoke to them in a great voice. So then the next verse describes his speech, which is equally gorgeous. So here he stands up and all eyes are attracted because he's like the moon rising among the stars. So then it's described he has these various markings and the proportions of his bodily construction is that of a very auspicious person. And then it says because he had to go into the sacrificial arena and be initiated to perform the sacrifice, therefore he had to take off his chadar and his dhoti and put on this deerskin and kusha grass ring so everyone could see then his, they were watching so they could see his natural beauty of his body like that. So this, first of all, Prabhupada points out that these beautiful bodily features are especially characteristic of kshatriyas. He says both men and women, they are noted for having very beautiful bodies. Prithu, of course, is especially the incarnation of the ruling potency of the Lord. He's meant to rule the earth. His name Prithu is the masculine counterpart of Prithivi. Prithivi means the earth, so Prithu is the masculine ruler of the earth. And so he is definitely in the he's an exemplary kshatriya, so he has that beautiful bodily features. This is also mentioned, for example, that when Arjuna and Bhima went to challenge Jarasandha, they disguised themselves rather ineptly, as it turned out, as brahmanas. He gave them the hospitality due to brahmanas, but it points out that Jarasandha could recognize right away that in spite of their disguises that they were kshatriyas. On the one hand, they had indentations in their shoulders from carrying bows. You carry a bow and gradually, I guess, the string will make a mark that doesn't go away ordinarily. So he saw that. And he also saw that their bodies were very beautifully and well constructed. Brahmanas' bodies are typically very skinny because they live on charity and often that's a very precarious existence. And like Sudharma Vipra. And the Brahmins are instructed that as far as where your food is coming from, if nothing comes in charity, go out to where they thresh the grains and pick up what's they didn't gather, the stray paddy. That way you can live. So Brahmanas, the tendency toward skinniness, etc., is there. So these Brahmins were well muscled and they had big, described here, large arms, like muscles like eggplants and so on. They were not. So their beautiful bodily construction gave them away. And also their voices were very grave and commanding. In the military, a leader is supposed to have something which is called, I think, command presence. The kind of person that just stands up and gives an order, naturally everybody wants to obey. So their voices are very grave and commanding. So these particular bodily features, so especially their bodily beauty, it gave them away. So in spite of being dressed as brahmanas, they were noted. He noted they were kshatriyas. So here also, his beautiful features are described of Maharaj Prithu, and so everyone was eager to see him in that way. He's such an exemplary kshatriya. So Prabhupada says that you get the body you deserve. He says, Prabhupada quotes this aphorism, the face is the index of the mind. I'm going to quote another aphorism. I think, I don't know who coined, who said it first, Noel Coward or somebody like that, that after 50 you get the face you deserve. It's a sort of a corollary of this one. And there's a famous story by Oscar Wilde, The Portrait of Dorian Gray. I've forgotten the story now, exactly how it went, but this man was a debauchee and a libertine, and performed many, many sinful actions, but he was very beautiful in his youth. And somehow or other, there was a deal, if anybody can remember the plot, but I can't remember how it happened, that there was a portrait made of him, and that instead of his debauched, sinful lifestyle appearing on his bodily features, the portrait would bear all of that. So that as he grew older and older, and more and more degraded, performed so many sinful activities, he maintained a very beautiful face and youthful face that didn't reflect what would naturally have happened to him, to his face as a result of his mentality. And of course, at the end of the story, the portrait's finally is revealed, and this just hideous, hideous, ugly face is there, the portrait of Dorian Gray, and he dies, and then the painting is back to a painting of a beautiful youth, and his own bodily features then reflect his depravity, the filthy state of his soul is there. So this is the face is the index of the mind. This is generally recognized, and so this is one's mental constitution is exhibited by his facial features. The bodily features of a particular person are exhibited in accordance with his past deeds. So this is happens that first of all there's consciousness. And the soul in the material world has its particular consciousness, and that consciousness determines the form of the body that he will get. Your body is a consequence of your past good and ill deeds, the body that we have now. So these things are distributed by karma. Past good deeds mean one of the things is beautiful bodily features. That's a sign of past pious activities, along with, what are they? Beautiful bodily features, born in a highly placed aristocratic family, have a good education, and wealth, to be wealthy. So conversely, if there's a person who is low class, ugly, ignorant, and poor, you can understand that these things were due to past sinful activities. So beauty and ugliness also, they reflect. But one has to be careful here. This is due to an inheritance from the past. Various people are trying to end discrimination based on unfair characteristics. So just as there's been a liberation movement for black people, liberation movement for women people, liberation for movement handicapped people, there's also others. There's a fat liberation movement. There's also an ugly liberation movement. People that are ugly are unfairly discriminated against. This is unfairness. This is a fact. There is an ugly... ugly people. And there's been a survey, a scientific study done that they have taken photographs of ugly people and good-looking people, and then they've asked subjects, typically college students, these experiments tend to be carried out by psychology graduate students, and so everybody who signs up for Psych 1 has to endure these things. So they get a sample of people and say, show them these pictures, pictures of ugly people and pictures of beautiful people, and say, describe the qualities of these people. Now all you see is the face. So typically, people who were good-looking were also described as having beautiful souls or beautiful minds, as being intelligent, kind, helpful, friendly, courteous, obedient, cheerful, thrifty, brave, clean, and reverent. You know, the repository of those are the, that's the Boy Scout qualities. I remember them much better than the qualities of a devotee due to my past sinful activities. These people that are beautiful tend to be thought of as having all good qualities, whereas those that are ugly are thought of as being mean, nasty, vicious, and so on. So this is a prejudice. There's truth to this. There is the fact that some people with very, very gorgeous bodily features or good looks may actually turn out to be quite nasty people. Famous case of the Empress Messalina, is that was her name? The Roman Empress, who was so gorgeous. She was beautiful, but is actually one of the more depraved monsters. She never got the face she was deserved because she was executed very young. So sometimes these people... So there's a time lag. It's a fact that if you're a very depraved and nasty person, after a while, the body is going to follow along. But especially when people are young, you can't tell yet. So people can be fooled. And there can be... These things are an inheritance from the past. So it is not necessary... You have to use this problem. It says the face is the index of the mind. But don't be superficial. You know, so when you see, you know, a picture of Marilyn Monroe or her latest incarnation, Madonna, don't think that these people have beautiful souls. Besides, there's always lighting and makeup. So there's an art of illusion that's there. But we do think like that. We think that people are... We think that, there's truth to this, that the body reflects the mind, and you can be fooled. This is, of course, also an artifice of stage production. In Shakespeare's play, Othello, for example, there's a villain, Iago, who's a nasty guy, and he's very, very duplicitous. One of his great lines is, "I am not what I am." And so, generally, in the Shakespeare plays, they have... The guy that plays Othello is really drawn up, you know. He's got typically a goatee, because everybody recognizes that nasty people wear goatees. And he's got black hair, and he kind of arched black eyebrows, and he kind of prances around and smirks and everything, like Vincent Price or somebody. In fact, Vincent Price did play Iago when Hollywood made a movie of this. So nobody's actually fooled. But I had a friend that said the best production of Othello they had ever seen was some college production where they cast as Iago some all-American boy with, you know, blonde hair and really straight look right at you in the eyes, blue eyes, and you know, every all-American boy mothers would love. And it was devastating when you could see this villain look like so nice and so pleasant. And it became obvious, it became the whole thing of how he managed to fool Othello became more striking, that you can be deceived. So when it says the face is the index of the mind, yes, you can understand that somebody who is not ugly, who is good-looking, that in order to achieve that, they've performed some past pious activity. But don't be superficial. You can see the face is the index of the mind, but you have to watch the face in animation. And so that you have to look at how a person communicates with their face, whether they're honest, straightforward, and so on. That has to be seen. So don't be fooled. And sometimes, of course, Vyasadeva, for example, was supposed to be very ugly bodily features. So there are exceptions like this. But it's true that after 50, a person generally gets the face he deserves. But you have to see how people are. For example, one's experience of Srila Prabhupada. Anyone who has actually talked to Srila Prabhupada face to face and watched him, you go away with the impression that this is the most beautiful person I've ever met. Because of the way how he smiled, you know, when Prabhupada smiled, it was just like the sun rose. I mean, everybody who's seen that, and the way he moved his eyes and so on, these things aren't carried over in still photography so much. Because that just captures a little slice of time. But to actually see somebody like Srila Prabhupada, yes, you can see clearly that the face is the index of the mind. But now people are so superficial, they don't know how to judge by these things anymore, and they'll take somebody whose mind does not yet reflect the state of their soul. They can be fooled like this. You wanted to say something? One's mental constitution is exhibited by his facial features. Then he says the bodily features of a particular person are exhibited in accordance with his past deeds. So let's take a face. Like, for example, let's take the face of a cat. That's a face. Now, if you actually look at a cat or a dog and say, this face is the index of a mind. So in a broad way, it is. If you actually look at a dog and say, this face is expressing the mentality of that soul, that reveals a lot. I mean, there he is with his teeth out in front of his eyes and this lolling tongue hanging out. Well, just today, you know, there's this cat that hangs out on the other side sometimes in my room. Look at his face and say, this is a person with this face. So in a broad way, there's something to be said for that. But when it generally means when we take the face as the index of the mind, it doesn't particularly refer to whether a person is physically ugly or physically beautiful, but how their demeanor, their facial features. You know, you can look at somebody and they may be saying one thing with their mouth, but you can see that their eyes are saying something else. Or they be smiling with their mouth, but their eyes are not smiling. So we learn, it's a whole art of how to read a person's face. But some people are good actors, they're very clever. They can deceive that way. The best liar is the one who learns how to look you straight in the eye. You know, some liars, they're shifty-eyed. And so you can understand, no, this person has a shifty, dishonest mind because you see his eyes are shifty. But there are others who can look you straight in the face and just, you know, and then you get fooled. So one has to be careful. But the idea that one's mental constitution is exhibited by his facial features. And so Prabhupada says, the past deed, according to one's past deed, his next bodily features, whether human society, animal society, or demigod society, are determined. So also in human society, there are different bodily features, broad categories like that. In the Divine and Demoniac Natures chapter in the Bhagavad Gita, when Prabhupada mentions demoniac species, he mentions hunters in the forest. Now by this means, he means aborigines, aboriginal tribes of people in the hunting, gathering stage. That is to say, there are forest tribes, mostly extinct nowadays, but they used to be, who do not yet have settled agriculture, and they live by hunting and gathering. They live in the forest. They're nomadic. They go from place to place. They don't, you know, they may plant a few roots here and there, but basically they don't have a settled crop. These are uncivilized people. And so that's considered to be a result of demonic activity, is to be born just a little better than animals. Of course, when we think hunters in the forest, we think of these guys, you know, with the shotguns and the red vests and things out there blasting away at the deer population. That's also true, probably. the modern equivalent of that, those hunters, but Prabhupada's referring to the aboriginal types of people. So that's considered to be, oh, what an unfair judgment, you know. We've learned culture relativity, and these people, they have their own thing and their own lifestyle. But actually, you're born under different circumstances according to your past sinful and pious activities, and you may get a body. Why people are born, like in a northern climate, like Eskimos, that makes spiritual life very, very hard, where the only thing to eat is well blubber. And you may say, well, that's unfair. They can't be vegetarian. But they took birth in that particular circumstance. So if that favorable or unfavorable, just as we also know about pious birth is discussed by Krishna in the sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. So things are not, it's not that things are often so, at least it's not unfair. You can't take a particular thing and judge a person by, but still, it's there. So one has to recognize this. This is proof of the transmigration of the soul through different types of body. So this is the struggle. The struggle is to get a good body. And then that's described here in the 15th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says, the living entities in this conditioned world are my eternal fragmental parts. Due to conditioned life, they are struggling very hard with the six senses, which include the mind. Karshati, they're struggling with the senses and the mind. So this struggle is actually transmigration of the soul. So he describes the struggle. The living entity in the material world carries his different conception of life from one body to another as the air carries aroma. Thus he takes one kind of body and again quits it to take another. So here we have this particular body, which is an inheritance. Here at the time of death, I've got a certain mentality. So this, to the time of changing body, that's a time where I can make a bit of a jump. And so the mentality, I carry my mind. My mind is packed full of desires. My consciousness is there. That consciousness determines a certain kind of mind. And so according to that mentality, my conception of life, what is my idea? What is life like? What is my philosophy of life? I get a body that reflects that philosophy of life. The living entity, thus taking another gross body, obtains a certain type of ear, eye, tongue, nose, sense of touch, which are grouped about the mind. He thus enjoys a particular set of senses. So that shrotiyam, the ears are there, chakshusha, the eyes are there, sparsha is there, that sense of touch is there, rasanam, the sense of tongue, the right tongue, according to what you want, grahanam, the right nose. Where are these? Adishtaya manaschayam. These are situated in the mind. So that mind, that consciousness goes, and then these things are grouped about. So this body is a collection of these things, shrotiyam, chakshu, sparshanam. And that determines your environment. Biologists have this German word, Umwelt, which means sort of like environment, but it's the environment that a living entity perceives according to how he fits in. He has a certain ecological niche, what he eats, what's of interest and what's not of interest, what his senses are able to pick up and what his senses ignore. For example, in the Umwelt of polar bears, seals play a very important part. They have a different position in the Umwelt of polar bears than they say in the Umwelt of seagulls or something. You know, they have a different position. So all that, your conception of life, this determines your senses and your interests. What you're interested in. So according to that interest, you get that sense of touch. So with all this in mind, look at a spider. Look at a fly. Look at a mosquito. Look at a snake. Look at a cat. Look at a dog. That's an interest. That's a soul with a particular interest. And because of that interest, he has his nose, his snout, his proboscis. It depends. And that way you are allowed to enjoy in a certain way. Certain things become lovely and certain things become ugly. Certain things become desirable. Certain things become undesirable. You can enjoy in a certain way. That's consciousness. So why are all these 8,400,000 species of life? Why so many different faces on the street? Why so many different bodies? You ever look? I mean, there's so many different sorts of bodies, even among human species. No two are alike. That's all carried over by desire. That reflects a past consciousness. So, that, of course, that's the inheritance from the past that determines his consciousness. And there can be a time lag. And that's where if you develop Krishna consciousness, your body will not necessarily reflect in all respects your present state of consciousness. That if you're together mentally and spiritually, you're going to be together physically. That doesn't necessarily hold true because you have inherited from the past. Mentions here, Maharaj Prithu has an arched instep, so that if you have flat feet, that doesn't necessarily mean you're impious now, but maybe in your past you were. So this is the consciousness that determines this kind of thing. So as I said, look at a cat, look at a dog, and see. So that's Jnana Chakshusha, that's mentioned here. The eyes are chained in knowledge. The foolish cannot understand how a living entity can quit his body, nor can they understand what sort of body he enjoys under the spell of the modes of nature. But those who are eyes are trained in knowledge can see all this. Jnana Chakshusha, Pashyanti, they see, because their eyes are trained in knowledge. This is knowledge coming here from Scripture. So this is the body that you get your next life, that also will be determined. So that state of consciousness is there, and you see it as people's mentality change in this life. That's what it says. After 50, you get the face you deserve. That has been noted even by worldly minded people. And people who are very debauched and very sinful, they start to look pretty gruesome. So much strain, so much anxiety, so much lying, so much deceit. Believe me, that leaves its trace. And of course you see, as people get older and older, sometimes that happens. That's already been observed as Suchi has pointed out in his BTG, Vedic Observer, how the Ralston Purina Company has that look-alike contest for dogs and their owners. So this has been observed. The phenomenon has been observed that they tend to look like each other. After a while, people with that particular consciousness, they adopt that. And so you can see. I used to see these people standing in the corner of Market and 14th outside of a cigar store. And just looking at them, you could see somewhere in the Everglades a pond, and there's a turtle, a couple of alligators, and a few snakes. I mean, there was no question about it. This is a very reptilian bunch of old men standing there outside of this cigar store. It didn't come to me as a speculation. It came to me as an observation. I don't know if it was a correct observation, but it was there. So we have to be careful about this consciousness, because that will be there. Jagannath Swami, I Baladev Jai Suputra. So Prabhupada said this is proof of transmigration of the soul. Otherwise, what is the explanation? So many different species of life, so many different people. Some are born this way, some are born that way. Why so much diversity? Why so much variety? That's to satisfy the desires of the living entity. So you end up advertising the way you are. You know? Prabhupada said at one place, he said, if a dog knew he was a dog, he'd be so embarrassed. So that is actually very embarrassing. Everything is revealed. You can't hide things for long. So what's in the mind or consciousness, so sooner or later it comes out in the body. That can be understood. And you can see where people are going. The future is visible. It's just like Prabhupada gave the example of a person has purchased a ticket for London. He's on the plane for London. Then you can assume that his destination is going to be London. So you look at a person. You see the modes of material nature they are situated. You see the consciousness. Then you can understand, yes, that will be your future. That's your fate. You've made your destiny. You've created your next body, and now you're going to have to live in it. So this is Patshyanti Jnana Chakshusha. So we have to know these things. This is a science. We have to see this clearly. So any comments or questions? Yes, Prabhu. Spiritually, according to your bodies, no, obviously it's not true. Spiritually it's true. If you want to say equal before the law, you can argue that point. But equal in every respect? No, everybody knows that. Everybody knows that. You may wish it weren't true, but your wishing it weren't true does not make that so. And if, just like our educational policy, so afraid to discriminate, you know, You can take it pretty far. Pretty soon you may have a stupid liberation movement where stupid people are being unfairly kept out of, and they show that among mathematics professors there is professors of mathematics and physics, there is no one with an IQ of under 70. So this is indiscriminate. They must have a certain number of mathematics professors who have in the dull normal range. I mean, this course carrying it to the point of absurdity, but some of the other things that are there are like that.
We were mentioning how species characteristics are balanced. Mm-hmm. But we understand also that the soul transmigrates from species to species. Mm-hmm.
The first time they go up the evolutionary cycle, everybody's just trying everything out once. You sort of have this gamut of material desires, and you get one after another to give everything a taste. Then after you come to the human form of life, then you may choose. But still, that's the mentality. The mentality's there. Animal behavior in this respect is very instructive. Not just how they look, but how they act. Yes?
I'm sure Prabhupada many times says that in the human form of life, one can make progress in devotional service. So what is the standard?
What is the standard of what is a human? Human means to follow Varnashram Dharma. What Prabhupada says is actually human civilization. Human civilization begins when there is a following of Dharma. So there's, of course, there are different ways when they say, when also it says there are 400,000 human species in the Padma Purana, that may be a different criterion, because I understand primates are considered humans, what we call primates, monkeys and things like that I've heard. But anyway, actually when you become human, that is, you can make spiritual progress, and then that means you have to follow Dharma. So a so-called human society which does not follow religious principles is not considered to be human. First of all, you have to make people human beings. That means there has to be regulated sense gratification. But when there is unregulated sense gratification, then it's not human. Yeah. Yes?
Of course, karma is very difficult to manage, all the intricacies of karma. But what about the persons who are trying to be religious, but, I guess you can't say the Buddhists, because you understand that the Buddhists are transcendental. Maybe you could explain the difference between a devotee who's trying to come to the highest level of devotee, but has an occasional fall down, and somebody who's not performing bhakti yoga, but you know, performing some other genuine division, performing sinful activity, not intentionally, accidentally, not a bad habit, whatever. The destination is less similar.
A devotee who has an accidental fall down again takes up the process of devotional service, and if that he can quickly, soon Krishna says, it becomes rectified, so still considered to be saintly. Another person, whether whatever community they're in, this community, Christian community, that's not the distinction. Another person may not give up sinful activities. In other words, sinful activities may be programmed, scheduled into their program. That person doesn't have the same destination. Now, I also know people, at least who dress like this, who have sinful activities scheduled into their program. That's not an accidental fall down. That person can't be considered saintly. That has to be given up. Now, there's two ways you can, one way you can program it in is you perform a sinful activity, you recognize it's sinful, then you perform an atonement, and then again you recognize a sinful activity, again you perform an atonement. And that's also different. That's compared to the elephants taking a bath and then going back in. Well, the elephants, they take their bath, and the first thing they do is roll on the ground and coat themselves with dirt. So the intention should be, if one atones for a sinful activity, that one does not take it up again. If you keep on atoning and then keep on sinning, then you're just trying to take advantage of the atoning process to allow yourself sinful life. This kind of cheater never gets anywhere. Depends on what his consciousness is at the time of death. If a person is fully Krishna consciousness and has no material desires, then he'll go back to Godhead. If he doesn't, then he has to take birth, that's all. And that has to be seen. I don't think you can tell otherwise. Did you have a question?
We'd see some people heading to one specific
Yeah.
How does Krishna's mercy apply?
How does Krishna's mercy apply? That having done some agyanta sukriti, having tasted prasadam, then they don't go to the Everglades. They at least take birth in Miami, maybe a little bit higher. So you get a human form of life having tasted, or some other thing, that you do some good deed for a devotee unknowingly, just going from Newark airport station to the train station. It turned out the taxi ride was $11 instead of a different price. $11 the taxi driver wanted. That's fixed rate. Worse than the Newark taxi drivers, or worse than Calcutta taxi drivers. But I happened to have, there was a guy in the car with me who like just gave me, because I was trying to, you know, in the taxi, paid part of my fare for me. You know, that's devotional service. And decided because he was a nice guy. You know. So he was taking the taxi further on. He said, I'll deal with the taxi driver later. So he did. He did me a favor. And that's agyanta sukriti. And what does that mean? It means at least that in his next life, he'll have some more association with devotee and an opportunity to engage more in devotional service. That's what it means. Doesn't mean that you make a lot of advancement necessarily, but at least you get the opportunity. Just like people that come to this movement, just like the opportunity, because it's generally considered that devotional service is a continuation from past life. So we have lots of people who engage in a certain amount of devotional service and don't go any further. So that may be due to agyanta sukriti in the past. So the number of opportunities you get, the number of reminders you get, that's there. Yes?
If human form of life is responsible for karma, and the animals are not responsible for karma, then in human society, that's members that follow Varnashram Dharma. Does that mean that the persons who are not following Varnashram Dharma are not responsible for karma, for their activities?
No, they're responsible. They ought to follow Varnashram Dharma, and they've elected not to. What these borderline people are, like aborigines and things like that, that I'm not certain. But generally, human form of life means you create karma. I don't know why a person takes birth in that kind of... usually that's having taken birth in that, as having been a human being. And that is, human beings means you have a choice. And you have a choice. You can do good or you can do evil. You can do right, you can do wrong. So you make a choice. So you're responsible. Sometimes, as a result of past bad choices, you're put in a situation which really predisposes you to evil. The punishment for sins is more sins. If I'm born among sinful people as a result of my past sinful activities, then I'm going to perform more sins, maybe harder. For me, the weight of my past sins may make it much harder for me to make a choice toward piety because of my bad association. I've chosen that association. It may make it hard, but there it is. And so, generally, once you're a human being, what we call a human being, that's your choice. Then you can choose. What did I know about Varnashram Dharma? I was responsible before I became a devotee. That responsibility was on me. So this animalistic civilization that has been artificially created doesn't mean that all those people are now free from the responsibilities of human form of life. No, because they ought to be human. And we're born into this animalistic society because of our past misdeeds. Our past bad choices. And the fact is, we again, by great good fortune and mercy of Lord Chaitanya, again was able to come back to Krishna consciousness. And that'll happen no matter where you are. If you choose Krishna, then Krishna will be there. Okay? Oh, he has a capacity. No, he has the capacity. Somewhere deep inside, that's there. He can choose. He's responsible. He may, because of so many bad choices in the past, he may look like he can't choose anymore. But he's responsible. And you never lose your free will. Even of course the cat and the dog has free will, but they're that choice for spiritual, that option for spiritual life is not there. Now there are people who approach that. When you see a human being that lower degraded, then you can see that this person has made a series of very bad choices. Shubhanani, you want to say something about that? I haven't heard anything about that. All I've heard is that three kinds of living entities take birth as human beings. That monkeys and ignorance, lions and passion, and cows and goodness. So it would seem that some come up as human beings in the mode of ignorance. You know about this?
Well, the Bhagavatam says you go back to the same place where you fell, where you degraded yourself from. In other words, you have a certain form of human life. Mm-hmm.
So you were a human being. You had reached a certain status as a human being. Then you fell down from there. And then you work your way back up to that same status.
From animal life, you go into
that status. Right. Well, you're talking about like the very first time the soul reaches a human form of life. I mean, that I've never. Yeah, then he comes down. But then he comes up. When he comes up, he wants to know what is the first, you know, opportunity as a human being does he get?
From where he created himself to go down.
No, but that's Brahma.
No, but I mean, in human form, when you're coming down,
wait a minute. When you fall down from a position of Brahma, do you go down to the bottom and work your way up, or do you work your way down from there?
You go down gradually.
In other words, you come from Brahma to a demigod, then to a human being, and then you go down? That wasn't ever clear to me. Is that the way you understand it, Shubhananda?
The human platform is where you go up or down.
Right.
You don't fall from a lower to an animal.
My understanding has been in the past that what Prabhupada had said is that you gradually work your way up. You first get a chance to go through all the animal species of life, then you attain a human form. And that first one, in those animal species, the first time it's automatic progression. Then you attain a human form. Then your choices begin. Then later, I heard that Prabhupada said, this is the way it has always been explained to me, and from what I'd seen, then later Prabhupada said that you first get your chance as Brahma, and then after that you go down and you start at the bottom and work your way up. That was my understanding. Maybe it's wrong.
Normally, when one is up in the higher, then it comes to human form first.
Yeah.
It doesn't go directly to
animal. So that would be if he was Brahma first, then his next thing would be a human form, and then after that. Then you progress your way up automatically?
Through the animal species, then you go to that human form and create yourself.
I'm not sure of that myself. I'm not, I have to look at that one up. Anybody have any insight into this question?
Right.
I want to. Anybody? What do you think, Shesh? Do you know? You know about this? Right. First, come to the material world. You take position of Brahma. then you fall down from the position of Brahma. The question on the floor is, do you fall down from the position of Brahma to a human being and then go down, or do you fall down from the position of Brahma to the Indra Gopa, whatever it is, and work your way up to a human being? As Brahma? Maybe, could be, perhaps. Anybody know? Siddhamani? Well, yeah. What do you think, Shage? Did you ever realize there was a... Did you think like he thought, or do you think...
It seems more logical.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Could it be the distinction between human species and others is not the body, the state of consciousness, the body not being the definition of what is human, but a tato brahma jigyasa, that when a living entity
Yeah, no, because the ability to acquire into Brahman. We can step outside and I can show you on Germantown Avenue somebody that's a human being, but it'd be very, very difficult to get that person to inquire into Brahman. You may say that practically he can't do it, but still, this, because he's become so degraded. Now, maybe if you sobered him up, took away his drugs, you know, put him through a program, you might bring him to that potential. So because he has that potential of inquiry into Brahman in this body, then therefore he's human. Now, no matter what you do to your cat or your dog, you'll not be able to get him to inquire into Brahman. It just doesn't have that. The body allows a consciousness to be revealed. That was an exceptional case. He fell down from a very, very high platform. But in the whole state of Pennsylvania, you'll not find another deer like that. Yeah?
This is a question that
I've been wondering. Yeah, right.
It doesn't seem mathematically possible, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, right. Krishna's amazing, huh? Kapila?
In this other case, if your only country was fell directly in spiritual giant fell.
Yeah. They didn't take that was also a special program. We're looking for the rule. I'd like somebody to just find the passage if they can, wherever the place is, that Prabhupada says, you fall down from Brahma, and look at what he actually says. Because I don't know if I've ever actually seen that place as Prabhupada described it. I don't know anything Prabhupada hasn't told me. You know, so he hasn't told me, I don't know. What? Yeah.
Birth,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's
so,
right.
If you're falling from the heavenly planets,
mm-hmm. Heavenly planets means Surya Loka, but Brahma Loka is a little different. You do not fall down from Brahma Loka. And Brahma has a lifetime, and when he dies, the universe ends. So you're not going to fall down in the rain from the position of Brahma. So that doesn't apply to him. We have to stop now, interesting as though this is, because...